Today, I invite a good friend of mine, Dan Delario, on to the podcast. And we do what's called an AMA, an Ask Me Anything. And I don't do a lot of these on this podcast, but this one I had a lot of fun with. We dive into how to build culture, when to terminate, when to elevate, and many, many more topics. So listen to this episode. You're not going to be disappointed.
Leaders are not born in a womb. They are forged through heat, pressure, and a whole lot of sweat. The Fireforge Leader Podcast serves the audience through exploring leadership at work, in the community, and with the family, using a practical perspective and real-life experiences from the host, Steve Baumgartner, and his guests in the Forge. Now, it's time to enter the Forge with the Fireforged Leader.
Hey, y'all, welcome to the Fireforged Leader Podcast. Today, we got a special guest on. Dan Delario, hopefully I said that right, because
you got
way
it.
Too many vowels and not enough consonants, man. Anyways, Dan and I have been friends for a couple of years now. I use the term kind of loosely, but no, I'm kidding. Dan's a good friend. Anyways, Dan, if you could just give all the listeners a little bit about yourself, that'd be awesome, man.
Yeah, sure. So, like you said, Dan Delario, met Steve through the Iron Council, where we were both working on bettering ourselves. And in that time, I started up a small podcast as well. It's called Untaming Masculinity, where we explore all things that are related to being a man and being a better husband, father, and community member. So did a little bit of work over there. And otherwise, you know, in terms of leadership, I am an engineer, and I've been in program and direct engineering leadership for the last 15 years or so. I run right now programs for a defense contractor where we do work for safety equipment in aircraft. So a lot of seat design, which is kind of interesting work, as well as some other peripheral stuff. But run one big project for them. And in my past, I've had teams of up to 15, 20 guys under me. So it's something that I've had a lot of experience with over the last couple of years.
Right. Dan and I are both Gen Xers. We know how to give jokes, and we also know how to take them.
That's it.
So anyways, Dan has an awesome family. Marissa's your wife's name?
Yes.
Your wife's name, if I remember right?
Yep.
And you have a couple of twin daughters.
I got Marissa's my wife. We've been married for, it'll be 20 years this summer. So that's a big one coming up. And I got twin 14, going to be 15-year-old daughters, freshman in high school. So fun adventure in that that aspect, man. Life is a lot different once they get through middle school and into high school. So
No doubt. So, you know, I mean, everybody knows who listens to this show that we don't just talk about the workplace, right?
Right.
We also talk about home and out in the community. And, you know, being a girl dad and, you know, the only male in your house probably proves some pretty good challenges as far as leadership, doesn't it?
You know, it's funny. I was talking to somebody yesterday and we were talking about the difference between boys and girls. And I was explaining how with my daughters, there's so much crap going on in their lives, like socially, like with their friends. And I was explaining, I'm like, you know, boys, I'm like, that just wouldn't stand. Like, we would have been behind the school, we would have punched each other in the face, and then we would have been friends the next day. And it would have been fine. I'm like, whereas, you know, they're going through months and months of all this crap. And it's like, did you just talk to the person about it? You know, did you just address it? No, because that'll hurt this person's feelings. And this person kept the secret from me because they were trying to not hurt my feelings. And I'm like, I can't compute it. My wife just laughs because I get all like flustered over it. Cause I just want to come in and another thing about men, right? We just want to fix things. I come in and you got to do this. You got to do this. You got to do this. And she's like, you got to back off. Girls don't work that way. So it's definitely in terms of leadership and trying to guide people and help out. It's a lot different because I grew up with a brother and a sister, right? So we had more boys in the house than girls. So we kind of played by those rules. So I never had like the very feminine household growing up. It was always like, you know, we just kind of said what was on our mind and we kind of just got over it and got through it and didn't deal with the emotional baggage, I'll say, that kind of comes along with it sometimes. And I say that jokingly, you know, it's having girls is probably one of the best treats in the world too. They are very sweet and you know, I joke because I look at my parents and my sister's the one who's staying local and she's going to be the one who ended up taking care of my folks. Me and my brother, we both split, chase girls, you know?
Oh, for sure. And that's, you know, that's what's so awesome about men and women relationships overall, right? I mean, so the coolest thing I think about having, you know, we had more girls during our first trip around parenthood than now. So I know exactly where you're at, right? But the cool thing is it really helped me learn how to communicate. I don't think I'd be half the communicator I am now if I didn't have girls. But, you know, that's probably because of the same reason that I was telling my wife the other day, you know. I mean, I am right here. A goes to B, B goes to C, C goes to D, so on and so forth. And my wife is like a whole plate full of spaghetti noodles. And anywhere a noodle touches another noodle is a place for a turn, right?
Yeah.
So when she's telling me about something, you know, all of a sudden it's a left turn and then it's a right turn and another left and another left. And I'm like, I don't even know where we started, honey. But it's really activated, you know, getting into listening and trying to, you know, sit back and hear the full story before I respond.
So for me, I've had a very similar experience, right? And as an engineer, I live in patterns, right? Like that is my foreign language. It's understanding patterns. And when the pattern is that there's no pattern, it's very frustrating for me. But you know, you were talking just now about listening. I always consider myself a good listener. What I've realized with having, you know, mostly females in the house or all females in the house is that listening and understanding are two different things, right? I can hear what they're saying, but I have to be able to take what they're saying and then condense it, manipulate it, understand it much better so that I can respond in the way that they need me to respond. Sometimes they just need me to listen. Sometimes they do want my opinion or my help. As they get older, they want less and less of that. But, you know, listening to the problems, listening to the stories, and then understanding what's really going on and what they want out of the conversation has been a tool that it's actually a very valuable tool that I've taken back to other situations, whether it's work or, you know, some of the community stuff that we do, whatever it is. It's being able to take that information or take that tool set and be able to utilize it going forward is really useful.
Oh, absolutely. That must have been the dryer, huh? No worries, no worries. That's what fatherhood's all about, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, we started off talking, you know, Dan mentioned that we were both in the Iron Council. He led a podcast about masculinity. Overall, you know, masculinity in today's world, it's a dirty word by a lot of people. Yeah. But it doesn't need to be, right? I mean, we're just built differently, but when we're working the way that we should be working in society, it's an absolutely beautiful thing. You know, femininity and masculinity coming together as one, creating a family, learning how to work together, like what we just talked about. So before we go on, I just kind of want to clear the air there, because there's a lot of people who take this term masculinity and make it into something that it's not. They want to take the dirty word, the people who go out there and make it into a dirty word, and that's what they want to do, is set the example from that. And that's nowhere close to what masculinity is.
Well, yeah, in today's world, right, masculinity seems to be always preceded by the word toxic, and this term toxic masculinity. Well, toxic masculinity doesn't exist. Toxic masculinity is called being an asshole, plain and simple.
Right.
Right. And men can be toxic, women can be toxic, but it's not masculinity that's toxic. And that was a big part of what we were trying to work through with our podcast, was defining that, you know, being masculine and being a male, it's something I'm proud of, right? I'm proud that I'm a man, and I'm proud that I have those traits, and I'm proud that I can do certain things because of that. And it's nothing that makes me feel like I'm necessarily better than women, but there's certain traits and characteristics that I have, and there's certain traits and characteristics that my wife has. And I'm really happy that they're so different, because if we were completely the same, it would be, well, first of all, it'd be a boring life. But second of all, to your point, there'd be no balance, right? I think of with masculinity and femininity, I think of that yin and yang kind of thing, where it's, you need to kind of have both to make it all work and fit right. And it really frustrates me when masculinity gets thrown around as this dirty word, because it's not, right? It's just not. And to have masculine traits of, you know, strength and honor and courage and, you know, hard work and all those things, like I will never understand where people come along and think that those are bad traits to have.
100% agree, man.
Sorry.
100% agree.
Got a little bit on my soapbox there, but
no, and I'm glad that we're going down this road, right? You know, and on the other side of it, you know, my wife is an amazing human being, and she's not masculine, and I love her for that. Right.
Right.
She is totally feminine, you know, wears a dress every day. You know, she is, her heart is just amazing. Right. I mean, the heart that she has for our family, she would give up everything for our family. You know, I'm out here doing this kind of stuff. I'm building a name, building a brand, all that stuff. And she gives up social media and her pastimes and everything else to make sure that our family unit is taken care of, right? Totally selfless. And she's really the person who holds this family together, right? Now, I go out there and provide a pretty nice life for the family. But at the end of the day, she's like the glue that bonds it all together.
So it's interesting you described her as selfless, because I would argue that the things it implies that the things that you are doing are selfish, because you're pursuing things that you're interested in. But it's not, because you're pursuing a lot of them. Yes, you have interest in them, but you're also pursuing them to provide value to the family, right? If you were just going out drinking and partying and doing whatever you do to have fun while she was doing all those things, that would be selfish. But you're, like you said, you know, you're making a brand, making a name, providing for the family. There's nothing wrong with enjoying that journey as well. But it's still both sides being selfless in their acts. You know, people use that word selfless as I'm doing something that I don't want to be doing necessarily. It's not always true.
Oh, I would agree. Yeah, my wife for sure loves every bit of what she does, right?
Right.
She loves being in her Bible. She loves, you know, being with the kids, until she doesn't.
We've all been there.
Yeah, as a parent, I mean, we all come to that moment.
Yeah.
Let's be honest.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're exactly right. You know, I mean, there's just different skill sets within it, right? I think that's probably the best way to
explain. That's a good way of putting it. And it's complementary, right? You know, it's my wife and I always joke, it's like, you know, she takes care inside the house, I take care outside the house, right? That's complementary. Stupid stuff like that, but that's what makes men and women work so well together, in my opinion. It's just, it's how we play off each other's strengths and weaknesses. And it's a beautiful thing, really. Like when it's working, it is, there's nothing better in the world than a couple that is able to balance those strengths and weaknesses.
Agreed. So do you ever try and switch her during the winter when you got all that snow up there?
Do I ever try what?
Switch her. I'll take inside the house, you go out.
No, I just make sure I have a nice snow blower and we're good to go.
Oh, there you go.
I actually like, you know a little bit. I like the snowboard and stuff, so I actually like being outside in the winter. But, it's funny how that works. She is not an outdoors person in general, so pretty much anything outside other than she likes to take care of the garden. But that kind of goes back to a little bit of the providing, you know, the home provision part of it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. My wife's got a fairy garden outside, so I'm not sure what that's providing, but
places I could go with that comment, but we'll keep it PG here.
Hey. All right, let's get back to the questions, Dan.
All right.
I appreciate you joining me today, though, man.
No, it's always good to talk to you, man. We've been talking about doing this for a while, so it's good to be here.
Oh, for sure. All right. You want to get us kicked off with the first one?
Yeah, so we took a couple of questions on social media here. The first one comes from Joshua, and he says, how can you control negative pride at home and in the workplace? And then he follows up with, when it's affecting yourself and others around you in a not so good way.
Yeah, so I think that second comment, you know, just coming out of the gate, defines it a little bit, but probably needs a little bit more definition around it as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, pride, I'll boil it down to being an emotion, right? And emotions are really amoral when it comes down to it. It's just how we utilize them and the actions that we get from them, in my opinion, is where it starts becoming positive or negative. So me being proud of my kids, that's definitely a positive reaction to that emotion. Me being prideful of all the money that I have and, you know, doing this kind of stuff is probably a very negative reaction to that emotion, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the way that Josh really led into this is, I'm going to guess that, you know, I know Josh a little bit, you know, follow him on social media, know him from the past town that I was in. He's new in a marriage. And just thinking back to when I was first in my marriage, right? There was a lot of pride as far as, you know, I know who I am, right? And, you know, now I got this other person in my life who is, you know, going, hey, yeah, that doesn't feel too good when you say that to me or whatever, right? It's real easy to get, you know, to lash back out or defend yourself or that sort of thing. And I think that's probably where he's coming from. So I guess, you know, just over years and years and more years, where does that control come from for me? It's really giving myself space, right? It's giving myself space in those moments to allow myself to breathe and stop and think about, you know, and in the marriage, right? Does my wife really think that way about me, right? Does she think that I'm a loser? Does she think that, you know, I'm an asshole? Whatever the case may be, the thoughts that are going through my head at the time. So given the space and looking at her and seeing what her face says, or seeing her bebop or dance across the kitchen, right? That's usually contrary to what my brain wants me to think is going on in that moment. So that's probably my biggest piece of advice, is just giving space and stopping and looking at the environment around you at the time, because it's probably not what you think it is.
Yeah. When I read this question, I was hung up a little bit on the term negative pride. And I think you did a pretty good job of describing it. But the situation that I kept coming back to is, excuse me, it's when, and I don't know Josh at all, so I'm just picking a situation where I experienced, but, you know, when you're in a relationship and somebody looks at you and goes, I do this and I do this and I do this and I do this, what do you, you know, you don't do anything. That to me is kind of a negative pride moment. And we've all, especially those of us who were married or whatever, we or live with somebody, like, we've all experienced that. I mean, like I mentioned earlier, I'm going to be married 20 years this summer. Still run into it now and again, right? When either you're slipping or the other person is feeling frustrated. I find that one of the best ways to handle that is to take a step back and be like, what's causing this to come to the surface? Is it a me not, you know, pulling my weight? Is it something else that's going on in their lives that's just causing them to kind of go, I'm going to pick on my partner just because I need that moment of aggression. You know, what's causing this? And then trying to address it kind of goes back to listening and understanding, like we were talking about before, where you hear what the person's saying, but what are they really trying to convey? So, you know, I'd ask Josh, what is the negative pride? What's causing that negative pride? Sometimes, unfortunately, it's just the way that person is wired, right? And they just like to do the tit for tat. And you're probably not going to change a person like that. Probably not going to change a person in general, but if somebody's going to go tit for tat with you about what they do versus you do, and it becomes literally a scoreboard of, you know, we're going to start to fill out the column and see who does more, that's not a great relationship to be in. It's not a way to build a strong relationship. So take a look at it. Take a look at what's causing that negative pride. What are you doing? Are you doing anything to cause it? Are you doing anything to assuage the real problem that maybe is creating this? And then if it's just who that person is, then you have to decide if you want to be around that person. And I know, as he mentioned, at home or in the workplace, right? What we're describing can be either place. We're using home as an example, but I've had plenty of situations at work where I've had coworkers and or employees under me who have gone at each other and said, I do this, that, and the other, and he only does this. You got to figure out what's really going on there and figure out how that's going to play out. And if it becomes a scoreboard keeping thing, then that's a bigger problem than if it's really something that's causing the issue.
I like how you took that from the opposite side, right? You looked at it from the lens of maybe it's the other person in this relationship. And I think that's important. You know, if it's your own pride that's getting in the way, there's definitely something you can do about it, right?
Yeah.
But if it's the other person, you can try talking to them, but ultimately you're not in control. So you got to make some decisions and set some boundaries within that, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking right at my desk right now at Jocko's book, Extreme Ownership, right? Like we all like to think I'm the man, I can take on ownership of all the problems. Well, sometimes the problem is the other person, right? And you can't control that other person, especially if you're in a relationship of equals, like a marriage or a coworker. If it's an employee that's doing it, then you have a little bit of different role power there, but still at the same time, like there needs to be a relationship there. It can't just be you laying down the law all the time. So sometimes the problem is literally just the other person. And like you said, you can go, you can address it with them. You can talk to them about it. You can have an honest, open conversation. But that is pretty much at the end of the day, all you can do. You can't expect that just because you present them with the issue and present them with the facts that they're either going to accept it, and if they do accept it, change. You know, that's a big ask for a lot of people.
Well, it's interesting too. You know, it is a big ask because they don't know the emotions you're feeling. They don't know the thoughts you're feeling. They don't know all the gaps that you filled in with your own thoughts, right? So all that they're left with is that initial conversation. And then at that point in time, you're dealing with an entire set of things you don't know about as well, right?
Yeah.
Human dynamics are so damn interesting to me.
Yes, sir. But it's a good one, Josh. You know, I think he's got a lot to think about here in terms of digging into the whys of all of this and then figuring out his next steps.
So interestingly enough, just this last week, there was a gentleman that we were co-owners of a project is probably the best way to say it. And the leadership at the time that set us up for this really set us up in a bad way. And, you know, I should have completely owned it at that point and said, no, we can't do this. This is going to end up bad, you know, so on and so forth. What ended up happening, and this has been over 6 years ago, right? What ended up happening is that it put a stake in that relationship, and we have not talked, communicated, you know, we'll see each other at gatherings, you know, give each other the stink eye, you know, all that kind of stuff. But this last week, I just got to a point where I'm like, you know what? This is stupid. This is absolutely ridiculous. And I did take that extreme ownership example. And I reached out to him. I'm like, hey, man, this is what I should have done. You know, this is on me, you know, and I should have, you know, approached you a lot sooner. And we started talking over the last week, and it's been amazing, right? So I would never give up that extreme ownership example because in some points it does work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, I don't care what it was about anymore, you know. It doesn't matter. All it was pride being in the way.
There's two things there, though, too, right? There's the immediate situation where you're talking about the project, and then it's how you let that affect the relationship going forward. So
amen.
They're very tightly tied together, but I would say that dealing with the project is one thing. The fallout of it, you know, that's definitely something you can take ownership of, because from day one, you could have looked at it and been like, hey, listen, we had a good relationship before this. I know this happened. It sucks, but I don't want to lose all those years of our relationship because of one situation. Right. So you have to be able to sometimes separate different things and not let them just cascade on it. You know, I've had similar situations where you have a friendship and then one thing happens and all of a sudden you're not friends anymore. Right. And it may be like the dumbest thing. And it probably is something that I've lost friends for no reason. All of a sudden they just start hanging out. And it's like, part of me wants to address it. And part of me is like, screw them. If they want to be a baby, I don't want to be friends with them. You know? At the end of the day, that's my choice to make, right? I could have run it to ground. I could have addressed it and said, hey, listen, I don't know what happened, But if I did something, I'm really sorry. You know, we had a great friendship. I'd want to keep it that way. You know, is there something I can do to solve the situation? But sometimes pride comes in and takes over, and it's like, why do I have to be the one to step forward and do this? You know, why isn't that person stepping up and admitting that they potentially did something wrong too?
My response to that would be, why not you?
Yeah.
Right.
And I agree with you 100%. It's my point was, it's not always easy to be that guy, right? It's the right thing to do, but it's not necessarily the easy thing to do.
I agree. I'm actually kind of angry right now, Dan. I think that Bubbly should give me an endorsement. Or wait, that's a sponsorship, not an endorsement. I drink enough of this crap on these damn episodes. Anyways, I think we probably beat that to death. Hopefully yeah. Josh got something out of that one.
That's a good one. So here's an interesting one. You want me to jump to the next one?
Yeah, actually, I would like, you know, just looking at that list, I think that's better if you answer that one going out of the gate, because you just left somewhere and went somewhere.
Sure. So the question is, how do you know it's time to leave an environment that is hindering your growth? I could do an entire episode just on this, because I have two situations that I'm thinking of that had to make the decision to leave. So the first is with a company. A friend of mine taps me on the shoulder and says, hey, I want you to come work for me. Great guy. It was a great company. It was an incredible pay raise. An industry that I wasn't completely super interested in working in, but whatever. Take the job. Within a month, I knew it was a horrible, horrible, horrible idea. Stuck it out for 3 months and ended up leaving and going back to the original company. Hmm. And then I was with that company again for another couple of years, and I just recently left to take the opportunity that I have now. And both times, well, I guess there's three times of me leaving in that story, but the last two times, the one where I left the short-term job and went back to the company that I was originally with, and then most recently when I left that company and took the job I'm with now, it was tough because there's two things going on. There's the allure and the excitement of the new position, right? Like it's going to solve all my problems. It's kind of, you know, it's like the ring in Lord of the Rings, right? Like everyone wants it. And then there's the fact that you're sitting in a position that you know you're thinking about leaving, and it just makes it worse because there's something new out there. So Rob asks about an environment that's hindering your growth. That to me is easier to leave than necessarily chasing the dollar. And we were actually talking about this a little bit before we hit record, but you know, the idea of if a place is truly hindering your growth, like if you're an engineer and you're at the point where you're ready to move into project management or into engineering management, I'm just going to use examples that I'm very familiar with, and there's just absolutely no chance of that, then yeah, it's time. Like that, you know, it's time because you're sitting there going, I'm ready. I'm absolutely bored at what I'm doing. I've absolutely hammered what I'm doing. I've got the processes down. I can do this blindfold with one arm behind my back, but there's no opportunity for me to grow. That's when it's time to go. You know, when I left from the position I'm in now, I was sitting in a place where I was the director of engineering, director of manufacturing. I also had engineering underneath me. My team was the shit. Like I could go away for a week and a half and come back and things would still be like clockwork because I had set processes in place. I had hired the right people. We were just good. And I was not being challenged. It was hindering my growth. I wanted to get into that senior leadership level in that company. It would have been a VP level, you know, but I wanted to move into something that challenged me, where I went to work every day and it wasn't like, well, I got everything done in the first couple hours that I need to get done today because everything's just kind of in place. And I could watch YouTube all day now if I wanted to, you know, and there was just no opportunity there. That's when I knew that it was time to go. I wasn't going to be allowed to make any more money because I kind of hit the glass ceiling in terms of growth. You know, like, you're in this position. This is what we pay for this position. I understand that. That's the value I bring to the company. I understand that completely. But I want to make more. I want more challenging work. I want to get up and go to work every day and know that there's stuff for me to do that's challenging and exciting, and I'm providing value doing. That's when I knew it was time to go. And that was for a good change, right? That was nothing against this place. It served me well, but it's time for me to move on to a new adventure. The one before was, I'm absolutely miserable. It wasn't hindering my growth so much as it was hindering my personal happiness. I was waking up in the middle of the night with, like, you know, my heart was beating fast. I was worried about the next day. The work wasn't necessarily challenging as it was just like, it was an environment of defeatism almost. Like, no matter what I did, it wasn't going to be enough. We weren't going to win the day. And it wasn't a good situation to be in. And the growth path there, again, was not someplace that I necessarily wanted to be. So knowing that there's no room for you to grow or you're going to have a very slow growth path, slower than you maybe want, that's really when you know that it's time to kind of say, thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it. It's been terrific. And I found an opportunity where I can grow and I can move on. The one caveat I'll give to this, and I see it, I'm going to sound like a Gen Xer now, but I see it in a lot of younger people, is that they don't want to put the work in for a decent amount of time to get to those positions. They just want to be like, well, I was junior engineer for 3 months. So why can't I get that promotion? Okay. You got to be able to put the groundwork in too. And the way that I always explain to people is, if you can go to work, get your job done, and get at least 50% of your boss's job done for the day so that he can be doing other things, that's the point where you need to start going, okay, maybe it's time I'm moving up the ladder. But just because you do your job really well and you stay within that bucket, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're ready to move up the ladder. And you got to be able to do that for a sustained amount of time to make that happen. So curious to see what you're thinking on this.
Man, I'm glad I let you go first. That was amazing, because my thought was, how do you know when it's someone else hindering your growth versus you hindering yourself?
Yeah. Right?
And I like the definitions you put into place a lot. But I think there's some other components to that as well, right? You know, a lot of times we want to sit around and we want to complain, and, you know, it kind of goes into the last question a little bit, right? We have this pride. We want to think of ourselves up here, but we're not always up here, right? And sometimes we got more growth in us than we want, more than where we've grown to, if that makes sense. And sometimes I think we just need to stop and ask, right? We just assume that we're going to get noticed. We assume that someone's going to give us the promotion, mm-hmm. or do whatever, right? And sometimes we just need to stop and get out of our own way and go, hey, you know, boss, I've been in this role for the last 5 years, right? I feel like I got it down pretty good. And to use your rules of the road, you know, it's, I'm doing half of your job right now as well as all of mine, you know, and I don't say that with any 10 seed or anything, but I'm trying to figure out where my gaps are to get to that next level. And just be open for that feedback, right? Because sometimes I think we, at the end of the day, we still come from, you know, people who weren't as intelligent as we are now and had fight or flight, right? And that's part of the flight mentality is, well, I'm not feeling fulfilled, or I'm not feeling like, you know, I'm getting my just reward or getting what I deserve or whatever. But we never stop and ask. So we build up these mindsets and we say that someone else is hindering us rather than taking that ownership upon ourselves. So I think there's a lot in there to unpack, right? But I absolutely love what you're saying, because that puts the onus on you to at least get you out of the starting block, right? Okay, so I'm doing my job. You know, I've been observing my boss, seeing what he's doing. I'm doing some of his job. I'm taking a load off from him. Now I have space to where I can figure out what these gaps are and take those next steps, right? So that's my thought on it.
So I wrote down two things when you were talking. Perception is reality and self-promotion. The first, perception is reality, is, you know, you talked about going to your boss and having the conversation, which is something I didn't talk about that much. It's something I did, but I didn't mention it in my little spiel there. Perception is absolutely reality in these situations, right? Because we don't know what our blind spots are. So you may think that you're doing a bang-up job, and you may be doing, let's say, the tasks that you're supposed to be doing and some of the tasks that your boss does. But maybe, for instance, your boss needs to be a great communicator and you're not really a great communicator. You know, you don't speak well in front of people, or you don't write coherent emails, or your reports are missing data, or whatever it is. So you may not realize that, and you may, by having the conversation with your boss, be made aware of those situations where you can start working on them. And that may be what's holding your back. So that's perception is reality part. And then the other is self-promotion. The boss may be sitting there going, I got Steve in this role. Steve is great in this role, and Steve's going to stay in this role because I've got a killer in this role. And he may not know that Steve wants to move up and to the next level, take his job so that his boss can go do something else. Maybe the boss doesn't want to go do something else either. That's another conversation. But the idea is that you got to let people know how you want to move and what you want to do. Otherwise, they're not going to see it. They're not going to know. You know, so if I at least go to you and tell you, hey, I want to be in your position, what is it going to take to get me there? Now you're talking self-promotion and understanding, you know, your the reality of the situation. In my situation, I went to my boss and I had that conversation. I said, hey, listen, I'm doing this, that, and the other. I've taken this off your plate. I've taken that off your plate. You've been able to do a lot more of the business development side of the house stuff. I've taken a lot of the business operation stuff away from you. I said, what's it going to take for me to get to a VP level in the company? You know, I want your job. I want you to be able to move up too. And he looked at me point blank and he said, with the size of the company, that's just probably not going to happen. You know, unless the guys above me move on, which they were owners in the company at that point. So they're not going anywhere anytime soon. And unless we expand a lot, which I don't see happening, there's no room for that. So I understood my reality. He understood my self-promotion part. And I told him, I said, I appreciate that. I understand it completely. Like, I have the capability to sit down and go, this is personal, this is business, right? That was a business decision. As a business person, I understood that to make the company run the way it needed to, I could not have what I wanted. And I held no ill will to them in that bearing. But I also told them that that's not what I want. And I may find an opportunity that gives me what I want outside of here. And we came to an understanding that that's life and that happens. And unfortunately, sometimes you lose my boss's words, not mine. Sometimes you lose good people because of that. So act communication, right? We were talking about it earlier in the podcast. Communication is key. Listening and understanding and having those difficult conversations, but making sure that everybody is aware of where you're at. You know, and what is hindering your growth? That would be the other question that I asked Rob here, right? If you're in an environment that's hindering your growth, why is it hindering your growth? And I'm not implying that Rob is this way, but, you know, I had a guy who he was ready to be my floor manager. In fact, I put him on a personal development plan to get him ready to be the floor manager. Part of that plan was he had to unload his niche knowledge in a couple of different areas to other employees because he was the only one who could do those things. Mm. And he kept coming up with excuses as to why he wasn't able to do that. And then got really frustrated after about 9 months when we were meeting every week, and every week I was, hey, where are we at with this? Where are we at with this? Oh, I'm going to work with this person, that person. And it never materialized. And after about 9 months, he got really frustrated with, you know, we've been working on this for 9 months. I want this position, blah, blah, blah. Well, you're not doing what's in the plan. You're making yourself unpromotable because you're not teaching. You're hindering your own growth. So that would be my question to Rob. It's like, are you actually is somebody or something hindering your growth, or are you hindering your own growth? And this guy ended up giving us an ultimatum. I want the position. I want the pay raise. He ended up not working for the company the next day.
Yeah, at best, that works once, right?
Yeah.
So I like how you broke that down into getting in your own way versus, you know, someone else getting in your way. But I think it can branch off even more than that, right? So if you're getting in your own way, is it education, knowledge, you know, computer skills, whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. So identify those if it's in your own way. Now, the other side of it is, you know, you had a perfect example of, you know, a company that was hindering your growth, right? But it wasn't a person. It was the size of the company.
Yep.
Right? So if you can really break that down, get down to these branches, understand exactly what it is, it can help you with your next maneuver, right? I work for a very large company, which would never have that problem. But I could see a similar problem in, you know, I used to be in engineering, right? I want to be the VP of engineering, you know, of the entire United States company. Well, there's only one of those, right? So that could very well limit my growth too. But if I'm like, okay, well, I want to learn a new skill and I want to be a VP because I want to expand my influence to, you know, a larger group of people, you know, it doesn't have to be just in engineering. It could be in continuous improvement. It could be operations, whatever. That stops limiting my growth. So we need to understand ourselves enough to know. I'm kind of going off on a tangent, excuse me. But we need to know ourselves and our own boundaries as well, right? If I only want to stay in engineering, then I'm probably going to need to accept a little bit of defeat and be willing to go somewhere else who's got more opportunity.
And it goes back to what I was talking about before. You're putting in the time. Right? You can't, just because you want something right now, I think of my kids when I say stuff like this, but just because you want something right now doesn't mean it's available. Right?
Right.
If you want that VP of engineering role, listen, the guy who's sitting in that role, maybe he's been there for a year. Maybe he's been there for 15 years, but he's probably pretty comfortable in that role. And guess what? There's even less president roles than there are VP roles. So where's he going to go?
Right.
You know, as you climb that ladder, the positions become less and less available, regardless of the size of the company. Right. It's a triangle as it goes to the top. So to your point, you have to be able to take on different roles. A perfect example of this was at the company I just left. I was hired on as the engineering manager. I told them I wanted a director position. I'm like, I've been a manager for 10 plus years now. Like, I want to kind of move up, be a manager of managers. Okay, we understand that. Again, 30-person company, there's not a lot of... In order for you to do that, you're going to need to run two departments. Would you be willing to take on manufacturing as well? Okay. Yeah. That's what I want. It's something I'm willing to do. Did I want to just be director of engineering? Yeah, I wanted to just stay in engineering and not worry about production issues and quality issues and all. That's a completely different set of a problem space that I didn't want to deal with. But I wanted to have more influence in the company, more than I wanted to stay just in my little silo. So I took the opportunity and went. But you have to be able to make those, to your points, you kind of have to be able to make that balance. And at a certain point, you've got to be willing to say, where I'm at right now might not be the place where that next move happens for whatever reason. But you got to make sure that you're doing you 100% right before you start putting the ownership of the problem on the company or anyone else at the company.
That's probably the best instance of you do you I've ever heard, Dan.
Yeah.
All right. You ready to move on to the next one?
Yeah.
All right. Let's let her rip, Tater Chip.
Eric asks us, when is the right time to terminate someone's employment?
So this is actually a fairly easy one for me. You know, if it's your wife, probably, you know, when she screws up a steak.
Why are you letting your wife make the steak?
That's a damn good question. No, I'm kidding. I can't give up my wife for anything, but she won't let me. I hope she doesn't listen to this.
This could have been worse. You could have just said it was too expensive to do that.
Well, there's that too. So I usually ask people three questions when they want to terminate someone, right? Number one, do we train them how to do the job, right?
Yep.
So I don't know if you've seen that video of the guy. He's with his kid and they're reading directions on how to make a peanut butter sandwich.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've seen this.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous, right? So the guy's got this messed up, excuse my French, shit sandwich by the time that he gets done, you know, because he's reading the directions on how to do a peanut butter sandwich. And, you know, it's missing details and everything else. But this is what we expect out of people, is to take very limited information and make a diamond product out of it, right?
Yep.
You know, sometimes at work, I pull up these documents and, you know, they got this notepad full of freaking papers. And I'm like, so is that what I'm supposed to read every night before I go to bed for a year? Because that's what it seems like, right? It's like War and Peace in an SOP, and they want me to read 30 of these on how to do one product, right? When you could have probably done the same thing in a set of five pitchers, right? Anyway, so first, did we train them correctly? Second, did we tell them what the expectation was? And then number three, when they went off track, did we have a conversation at that point in time? Or did we really wait until it became a huge problem? And if the answer to all three of those is yes, then I'm willing to talk about the termination. If it's no, then we as leaders did not do our due diligence in the matter.
It's very interesting how similar we are on these, because I ask, not worded that way, but the exact same things, right? When we hired the person, did we set the expectation of what success looks like in this position? Did we give them the tools to achieve success? Training and actual tools.
Right.
Three, did we provide feedback on the quality of work that they're providing? So same exact criteria that you've got, right? And again, if we messed up on any one of those, then yeah, I'm willing to talk about termination. Our termination is off the table until we fix us. If we can answer yes confidently to all of those and we can prove it in clear, concise manner, then yeah, I'm willing to talk about termination. I never want to terminate somebody because of a major screw up, right? Everybody has bad days. Everybody has, just shit going on. Now, should you be bringing life to the office? No. But we're all human at the same time. So I've had situations where I've sent people home because they've screwed up so bad, but I will not just immediately fire them on the spot. And it's because the emotion takes over the situation, but I know that I have to think about those three questions first. Right? The other thing that I look at is a lot of times I live by the hire slow, fire fast mentality, which is kind of a little counter to what I just said. But if you hire slow, that actually allows you to fire fast, because if you hire slow, you are making sure that the expectations are clearly defined. You are making sure that the training takes place at the beginning, and you are the one thing that hiring slow doesn't necessarily do, but is good practice, is giving feedback. And I've always done that for engineers, I'll do weekly one-on-ones where literally half hour with everyone, everybody, if we come in, I follow, I don't know if you've ever listened to him at all, but Manager Tools, it's a great resource for managers. Yeah. First 10 minutes is for them. Second 10 minutes is for me. Last 10 minutes is about training, future, whatever. And typically it'll be 15 and 15. And the last part we'll get to when we need to get to it. But that weekly touch point allows us as managers to give feedback. And the 10 minutes that I have is not necessarily, I need you to do this, I need you to do this, give me a status update on that. It's talking about how things are going, talking about what I'm perceiving in the quality of work, how I see them interacting with other people, maybe providing some feedback on specific situations that occurred over the last week. So that to me is how the feedback happens. Now, like say a production line worker might be a little bit different, but I'm still having those touch points where I'm walking up and saying, hey, your desk looks really organized today. Like, great job. Like, that's how we keep product defects out. Or hey, I noticed, when you were doing this operation, you left the screwdriver on the mat, and that's a good chance to scratch the glass on this particular product. So maybe we can, make sure that screwdriver goes where it belongs, when you're not using it. But just kind of having those feedback, those touch points, making sure I walk around, make sure my guys know me, make sure they can also come to me. Because I found that being able to have that two-way conversation allows us to give the feedback and sometimes even allows them to ask for feedback more. So hiring slow, making sure that you're getting the right person for the position, you're defining the role clearly, you're defining the expectations, and you're providing the training up front. And then those conversations are key in terms of the feedback. Because that's the worst thing that could happen is, and I'm sure everyone listening has experienced this, where you work for the whole year, the end of the year review is an absolute bum rush of job by the manager. Everyone gets the same kind of, you know, standard comments for the 1 to 5 rating in all the different areas. And it really doesn't mean anything. There's no real feedback that occurs there. My goal is always that whatever's on that piece of paper at the end of the year should be absolutely not a surprise. We should have been talking about it for the last 51 weeks. And that 52nd week is just a formal documentation of it.
Agreed. I actually wrote down should never be a surprise.
Yeah.
I'm glad you got to that point, right? I mean,
yeah.
That's probably a fourth thing, right? Is that nobody ever should have a shocked look if you go to discipline them or terminate them or anything else, right?
Yeah.
They probably, you know, more times than not, they should be on the other end of that. And if they are getting terminated, they should know exactly where they're at in the process. And they probably won't even show up to the meeting because they know what's going to happen.
Yeah. And I'm assuming with this question, we're not talking about something egregious like, you know, a fist fight in the middle of the cafeteria or a, you know,
oh, agreed.
You know, something like that.
I think they probably need to go back to, you know, manager 101 training if that's the case, right?
Yeah.
Because they asked, you know, when should you know?
Right.
The other thing too, you know, that you mentioned is those touch points, right? I got asked here a while back at my current role, you know, how were you guys able to drop turnover so dramatically? And the only things that I can come back to is, number one, we took chaos out of the system. And number two, we talk to people, right? We keep them in the know, right? Nobody wants to come in. You know, we're in the middle of a major project right now. Nobody wants to come in on Monday morning and walk into their workspace, not mine, right? And have it totally look different and not even know about it. But that's how sometimes we manage and lead in, especially manufacturing environments. I find it absolutely ridiculous. But there's so many places who keep their employees in the dark. They don't tell them what's going on. You know, they don't tell them the whys.
Yeah.
And they don't go and simply go, hey, I don't know what the example was, but when you leave that there, it scratches the glass, right? They don't have those simple communications. They want to wait until it's a big problem before they have a hard conversation, right?
It's funny you bring up that part. So with my manufacturing team at my last place, this is something I used to do with the engineering team all the time, but when I took over manufacturing, I did it with them as well. I would go over the numbers every month with them. I would show them, this is our sales, this is our bookings, this is our sales. You know, we typically ran it like a 3-month lag between bookings and sales, but you know, this is quality numbers, all the pertinent information. And I would tie it back to what they were doing. All right, guys, this is, you know, and the quality one was a big one with the manufacturing guys. It's like, this is what second time builds are costing us. This is how it's eating into the profit, right? The key to that was you know, this is how it ties into the profit. So what? We're a multi-million dollar company. We're cutting into, you know, a couple $100,000 worth of profit every month. Who cares? Well, no. Every quarter, you get a profit sharing check, right? So percentage-wise, if we hadn't had these quality issues, here's how much extra money would have gone towards those profit sharing checks distributed amongst all of the employees. So now you're taking money out of your own pocket by causing these issues. So how are we going to fix this? Because you're taking money out of my pocket too. You're taking money out of Joe's pocket and Mary's pocket. And so by making these improvements, we're going to all make more money. It's not just the company making more money, right? So that was part of it, but it was also you're part of this, guys. Like, you're not just coming in here and building a widget every day and going home. Like, you are key. You are a key part of this whole thing. We can have engineers sitting there and design on their CAD machines all day long, make pretty pictures and come up with grand ideas. And I'm an engineer. I'll be the first to admit that we come up with ideas that are sometimes poor shit. But it's the guys here who are, you know, the people on the floor who are building it and inspecting it and getting it out the door, shipping it, you know, packing it, the whole nine yards. Like, without you, those wonderful designs are just ones and zeros on a computer. Like, you're a key component to this. So it was building it up. And this might kind of play into our next question a little bit, but it was building up that morale in the team that kind of, you know, gave them the touch point. So, you know, back to the question here, right? The touch points. That was part of it too, was not only individually talking to them, but as a team collectively getting them all on the same page towards, this is our goal as a team. And I'm going to help you if you fall down in a certain area, just like you're going to help me if I fall down in a certain area. And we're going to work towards that goal. And that really helps to the point where very rarely did I end up having to discipline, let alone fire somebody for performance, because people were there to support each other and then collectively, and then I would come in and have that like final checkpoint or touch point with them of, hey, things are going good, things are going bad, this is maybe where I see you could improve, or, hey, you know, you're really good at this, maybe you can help Joe in this situation, kind of thing.
Well, we see it in the men's groups that we're part of, right? When men are on a mission, they march stronger and faster towards the goal.
Oh, yeah.
When they feel like they're a part of it. People are that way innately, right? I don't care if it's man, woman, child. When they feel like they're part of something, that's why we have good football teams, soccer teams, whatever, right? I think it's lacrosse in your world, right? Isn't that what your girls play?
They used to, yeah.
So, I mean, when people are put on a mission, they just do phenomenal things. So put your people on a mission, right? And then don't worry about the terminating people. That's few and far between.
Yeah. And again, that ties into this next question here really well, right? How do you get a team to work together, to actually be on the same team? I'll jump in. My first thing is you got to set a goal. And you got to get not only a goal, like you could have a team, I'll go back to the production team. We need to build 1 million widgets so that we make $3 million this month. Why?
Who cares? Yep.
That's such a huge number compared to the you know, the $20 an hour that I'm making building these widgets, that it really doesn't matter to me whether we hit 2.8 million, 3 million, 3.2 million. I'm still going to get whatever I get and go home every day. Why is that important to me? The goal has to be a goal that means something to everybody on the team. And I'll say another thing that works to get a team to work together, competition. Competition really works. I don't care who you are. Everyone's got a little bit of competition in them. Some people got a lot of bit of competition in them, like me. But everyone's got a little bit of competition in them. And if you get Team X versus Team Y, let's say we're building widgets, and you get two teams, and you need to build 1 million, and whoever builds the most that quarter gets $100 bonus person. It's not the bonus. It's not the $100 that matters. It's winning that matters to them.
Yeah.
Right. And everybody wins from that.
Peanuts.
Yeah. So it, you know, those are two, to me, easy things that you can do to get a team to work together.
Agreed. So, you know, you talk about the competition and you talk about, you know, putting an objective out in front of them. But I would almost say that all can come together as one, right?
Mm-hmm.
We are going to be the best widget manufacturer in the world, right? Imagine a world where this widget is the only one that customers want to buy, right? I mean, you just build it into your playbook, right? You know, you capture what people are tied to, the competition, you know, the desire to be the best, you know, all this stuff. I don't care what people say nowadays on social media. That spirit of competition and wanting to do a good job is just bred into the fibers of our being, right? You know, there's some people who fight it, but they're just, let's just admit it, they're stupid. they are. I mean, come
they
on.
They are.
Now. I mean, it's, you know, people are fighting. I mean, just this, how we're built at our core, right? Anyways, go ahead. I'm sorry.
What I was going to say was, what we're talking about really boils down to building a culture, mm-hmm. right? And we see it again, going back to the men's groups that we're in, like teams that build a positive culture that push each other are the ones that succeed. And finding that culture, finding that thing to rally around, you know, competition is usually a good one, right? Pride is another one. Pride can be a dangerous thing. We talked about it a little bit before, but you know, pride in what you do, pride in your product, pride in your quality. I don't see anything wrong with that. You know, pride in the fact that we make the best widgets in the world. Come prove me wrong.
Yep.
That's building a culture and it's like a self-propagating prophecy almost. Like you're going to attract better employees then, because they're going to come want to work for the company that makes the best widgets in the world. You know, you're going to attract customers because they're not going to want to buy from the second best widget company in the world. They want the best widget in the world. You know, it builds upon itself. So you build that culture and it all kind of takes care of itself. But how you build that culture is the little things. You start with the competition. You start with the why, the objective, right? And then you tell them, here's the objective. Here's how we're going to get to the objective. These are the things that we're going to do, the things we're going to change. This is what you're going to do to make this happen. And then you celebrate the wins. I think that's where people get lost a little bit is, you know, we've got this big, hairy-ass goal down the road. But we could break that into 5, 6, 10 milestones. And we can celebrate each one of those milestones along the way. You know, it could even come down to, did we meet the quota for the day to meet the milestone at the end of the week, which meets the milestone at the end of the month? Shit. Let's talk about your lion's roar on the floor or whatever at your place, right? Like something little like that, that instills pride in people is a huge motivator. And it's silly little things sometimes, you know, silly little things, just like, here, everyone's going to get a team t-shirt and we're all going to wear it with pride because we're the best damn widget manufacturer, you know, here.
Sometimes I think we're too far disconnected as well, right? And I'm going to explain that here. During COVID, working for a protein manufacturer, our new mission became feeding the world. Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are the only people out here working. We need to make sure the world is fed, you know, all this hype around that. And I tell you what, people overcame some shit during COVID, right? Because they felt like they were part of something bigger than themselves. You know, they were solving the world's problems, you know, making the widget. What does that widget do? It's not just the gear. It powers, you know, the automobile for 200,000 miles, you know, that your family drives in and provides safety and security. And, you know, it's all that stuff that I think that we disconnect ourselves from in today's society, where there's hundreds of thousands of manufacturers making 100,000 different widgets, you know, and,
yep.
All that kind of stuff. So I think it's important for that the people who are at every level of that organization, from, you know, the janitor, frontline worker, mechanic, it doesn't matter who it is, needs to be tied to the mission of what the company is, right?
Yeah. And it's the story, you know, back to your widget that goes in the car that, that you drive to work, that feeds your family, that, you know, allows you to make more money, buy the house.
Whatever. Feeds a family, but.
Well, it drives the car that brings you to work, that pays the bills. And yeah.
There you go. There you go.
It's, you know, it's the whole, if you give a mouse a cookie kind of.
Exactly.
Thing. But.
Wonderful stories, by the way.
Yeah. But you just said the word there, stories, right? It's understanding the story behind what you do, right? Like that whole idea of we feed the world, right? That's powerful. Mm. I mean, especially when you're sitting there going, fighting for people to come to work because the rest of the world is on lockdown and staying home and scared. And, you know, we, politics aside, like that was a big thing, was getting people to actually show up to work. But if they understand the why behind it, and there's a story, and there's a compelling story, people buy into that. And people want to be part of a winning story, and they want to be part of something that matters. Right? So you, your job as the manager is to develop that compelling story and develop the why behind it. Why is this important? Why is what you do day in and day out an important task? Why, if you didn't show up, would this fall apart and not happen?
Exactly. Exactly. So. All right. We got anything else there, Dan?
There's one more, but I think we've kind of hit on it a little bit, but I'll read it here. It's, Kevin asks, let's say your team has hit some big hurdles and everyone is down in the dumps. How do you keep them moving forward? It goes really hand in hand, I think, with the last question, but
I would agree.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to point back to something that you said, right? And that's celebrating those small wins. So when I took over the job that I'm currently in, the team was, it had hit some hard times, right? And going back to the Lions story, you know, it was all about, you know what, guys, let's throw away those TVs that say that we're always failing and let's set our own benchmarks for a little bit, right? Let's get, you know, 2% more tomorrow, 5% more, you know, next week, so on and so forth. And let's celebrate those kind of things. You know, when you're sitting there looking at, I got to make $1 million, right, to pay off this debt. Nobody wants to do that. But if I'm going to, you know, say $5 this week, $10 next week, and just keep on building that, the end comes closer than what you think, right?
You get that snowball effect, right? It's it's victories beget victories in my mind. And if you start small and you make obtainable goals, then that's how you kind of get back on the positive, back in the black, or however you want to think about it. The other thing that you got to remember too is, you know, if your team has hit some hurdles and you're getting down the dumps and you're getting deep in the hole, like, it's your job to establish rock bottom. And the way you establish rock bottom is you stop digging, right? You stop digging in the hole. You determine where rock bottom is. And you, then you determine how you get out of that hole. And you celebrate every step up that climb out of the hole. It's not once we get out of the hole, we'll celebrate. It's, hey, we're 25% of the way out. Awesome. Great job, guys. Right? We're 50% out. Even better job. Hey, look, I can see daylight now. We're 75% of the way out. You're celebrating along the way. You're telling people and explain to them the job that they're doing to make sure that they understand that, yeah, we had a big hurdle in front of us. We had a big problem to get over, but we're hitting this thing in small increments and we're going to get there, right? It's the whole how to eat an elephant concept, right? One bite at a time. Like, took a while to make this mess. It's going to take a while to get us out of this mess, but we're going to celebrate the process along the way.
Agreed. So another thing, you know, just thinking about everything that you just said there, Dan, is as the leader in that position too, you know, it's definitely your job to figure out where that rock bottom is, but it's also your job to make sure that you can always see the light
Yeah.
Because if you're at the bottom of that hole and nobody can see the light and you don't either, guess where you're staying? Because you don't know the way out.
Yeah.
But if you grab a hold of that light and you can explain it to everybody else, right? If you can believe in it and be able to go, guys, I see it. It's right over there. All we got to do is march.
And
then people will follow you.
That last part, right? You got to believe in it, and you got to champion that belief, right? You got to be able to have people buy into your excitement over how you're getting out of it. You are the cheerleader. And you're, for a while, you're going to be the only cheerleader. But once you start getting little wins, what's that?
And sometimes it's even fake.
Yeah, it has to be in the beginning. Because I guarantee you, a lot of the times, especially if you're deep in the hole, you're going to be doubting yourself. But you can't let people know that. But once you start getting a little momentum, you're going to believe it. Somebody else is going to believe it. Somebody else is going to believe it. Before you know, the whole team is marching lockstep. And instead of picking up 5% every day, you're picking up 10, 15% every day. And that big hurdle that you had isn't so big anymore.
I tell you what, I have one supervisor who, you know, and I talk to everybody on in the ranks, right? But he's, let me see, 4 steps down on the org chart.
Uh-huh.
But I remember when I first got there, he was probably the most self-defeating person I've ever met in my life, right? But I had an interaction with him today, and, you know, there's a new goal and, you know, all that stuff. And he was one of these guys who, so are you going to hit, you know, whatever the number is? Well, I don't know. I'm going to try my best. I'll do what I can.
He was hedging his bet, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I'm amazed by him today because, you know, it was just one day I'm like, hey, dude, you know, and I'm going to leave his name out of here. But I went up to him and I'm like, I don't know why you have such a hard time believing in yourself, because I believe in you, right? And I've seen a lot of people succeed and I've seen a lot of people fail, but I know you can succeed. And, you know, I asked him, you know, about this new goal today. I said, so are you going to hit it today? He's like, well, hell yeah, I'm going to hit it. And I mean, to me, it didn't matter whether he hit it today or not, but just that confidence that he had in himself now is just the most amazing feeling. A feeling to me as a leader, right, is to see him exude that kind of confidence.
And, you know, that guy, because you spent that time with him, he's going to run through walls for you whenever you want now in the future, because you instilled that confidence in him and you were sincere with it. It's not just, right? A lot of this has to be sincere. You could have gone to the guy and fluffed him up and said all that stuff to him and not really believed it. And I don't care how good of an actor you are, he would have known. But the fact that you were sincere about it and the fact that you were really like, come on, man, like, I believe in you. Like, you can do this. Like, don't doubt yourself. That was all he needed to be like, well, shit, if Steve says I can do it, I can do it.
Yeah.
And now whatever you tell him he can do, he's going to succeed at.
You know what the interesting part about that is that I would probably say it to just about anybody because I believe in human nature.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a good guy, you know, don't want to take anything away from him, but most of the time, it's just people getting in their own damn way, right? They stop believing in themselves, and therefore they can't do it.
But that's a leadership thing, too. It's leaders who have employees who will run through walls for them are the leaders who walk out and push their people, but do it in a way where they show belief in them, right? I'm not going to run through a wall for a guy who just kind of sits in the back and is like, I'm going to give Dan exactly the job that I know he can handle and nothing more. And I'm just going to expect success and I'm not going to congratulate him, but I'm not going to chastise him. Right. That guy's, he's going to get whatever the effort is. Whereas if I've got a guy who's like, cheer me on, has true belief in me, but continues to kind of like put me right up against the edge and challenge me every time, but is always there to back me up and challenge me, man, I'm going to go to war for that guy every single time.
Agreed. Agreed. Yeah, I have a mentor that I worked for. Hell, it's probably going on 10 years now. And every time that I run across him, I talk to him on the phone, whatever, he stops and he just says, Steve, do you know how proud I am of you? Right? And I would do anything for that man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah. 100%, man.
Yeah.
100%.
That's it. You know, when people are, when everything's, the chips are down, it is really hard to do that. But the first step is to take a step back, kind of figure out where you're at, figure out how to stop digging, and then figure out, you know, small incremental steps up and get everybody on board and just celebrate the wins. That's the summation of it in my book.
Agreed. Well, we got pretty deep tonight, brother.
Yeah, man, it was good. you know, it's funny you sent over the questions. I'm like, ah, we'll knock these out pretty quick, but.
Oh, never. Deep thinkers, man.
We can talk.
Well, I think I can shut down my podcast now because, you know, I mean, we just gave them every leadership principle that there ever was.
So. Yeah. Well, this is a paid episode, right?
What's that?
They pay for this one, right?
Oh, yeah. We'll pay beyond this good. No. Uh-huh. I really appreciate you coming on, Dan. We're going to have to do a lot more of this.
So. Absolutely, man. It was a blast. I appreciate it.
Yeah, so hopefully all the listeners got something out of this. Hopefully we answered the questions, you know, that you were posing up. We tried the best that we could with the knowledge that we had off from social media here. So, wait, that sounded wrong. Anyways, once again, Dan, appreciate you coming on, and that's a wrap. Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you.
You have just experienced the heat and pressure of the forge. Remember, words without action are meaningless. Now, after the heat of the forge, shape your thoughts, quench your brain, then put your new tools to use, adding to your leadership. Tune in next week for more lessons from the forge.